Hello and welcome back to the Postural Restoration Podcast. I'm joined today by another fellow presenter for the upcoming April symposium on the basal ganglia disease is the title of the symposium, and we're going to get into that a little bit later on in this discussion. But I really want to welcome today's guest. Many of you already know Neil Hallinan, who by book and by trade and by credentials is a licensed strength coach, massage therapist, and a PRT, among many other avenues of clinical practice. Neil, it's really an honor today. I just got done telling you how much we appreciate you as a resource and really an extension in some ways of what our institute here on site does and tries to do as far as providing resources to others in the PRI community. And again, most of everyone listening today probably has either heard you or seen you through various avenues, whether it be your YouTube channel or other podcasts you've done, other conversations you've had with other movement specialists and movement-minded people out there. But again, just thank you so much for joining us today. And I'm really looking forward to sharing your story more on hopefully a personal level with some of our listeners. So thanks for joining.
I'm happy to be here.
Neil, previously had a brief conversation as far as such a unique hybrid of a clinician you are and the route that you have had and the journey that you've been on to get there. I can't really think of another individual that has the experience you do because of your firsthand exposure and coincides with your firsthand knowledge and your own experience with the science and really how that has driven you to where you are today, what you offer today, and who you are. So Neil, if you could just walk us through, you know, some of your quote life story before PRI and where you were at as far as, you know, your career and your professional journey. We talked a little bit about, you know, your previous career in IT work that you had prior to really diving deep into movement of all varieties. But walk us through some of that backstory and just kind of hopefully set a little bit of the stage for more of your current professional endeavors.
Sure. So my first interest in movement was because of the fact that I struggled with it. And that really first started, actually, we talked about my college experience with SI joints, but it goes back earlier because I had to give up pitching in the eighth grade. My right shoulder was basically like just shot in the eighth grade. Then the tinnitus started when I was 13, or tinnitus, however you want to say it. That started when I was in ninth grade. And then started getting hamstring pulls, adductor pulls. And then in college, SI joint blowouts. That's the only way I could explain it. And then when I got into my early 20s, then I started to get the neck spasms and then the plantar fasciitis in both feet for about 4 or 5 years, which was just misery. So after I always thought I was going to be a high school history teacher, but then I realized my senior year in college, I realized I didn't want to teach kids. So that was out the window. I graduated with that history degree, but I didn't really know what I was going to do. And I needed a job, so I got an IT job. And now I realize with my visual system that I didn't know was an issue. That was the worst thing I could possibly ever have done for my own body, was sit in front of a computer all day. And not surprisingly, my body got even worse. And I was just in constant pain for years, every minute of the day. It wasn't like there was never a respite from the pain, because when your feet hurt, you can't do anything. Plantar fasciitis is misery. And then the SI joints, the neck spasms, and the tinnitus on top of that, which then puts you into depression and unhappiness, and you get just locked into this vicious cycle of negative energy. And then there were some things occurred in life. My father died when I was in 2005, and I realized life was short and unpredictable, and that I couldn't spend my life doing something that I hated. And luckily I had no one to support, it was just me. So I was able to quit the IT world and kind of go out into Well, I didn't know what the heck I was going to do, but I had started dancing already. And that was the important thing, because I had found a book called Core Performance by Mark Versteegen. And back then they called it, he called it movement prep. And today it's, now it's referred to as dynamic warmups. And I bought the book. I was at Barnes & Noble. I bought the book and I tried doing these movement prep exercises, and I was still in tons of pain at that point, and I still had the plantar fasciitis. And I couldn't even do the movement, the warm-ups. And my body started to shake and sweat so hard. And I couldn't even do the warm-ups. And I was once formerly athletic. You know, I looked athletic. People were like, "What? Why are you in pain? You look like a normal person. You look like you can lift weights and you're strong." I mean, obviously, I didn't understand what was happening to me either. But I did those. I did struggle with those techniques, those movement preps. But they were, whatever they did, I don't know, but they were really working on hip range of motion. Now, I probably wouldn't do those things with people, because now I know about patterns. But back then, I just knew I had tight hips. And it was enough to get my plantar fasciitis to start to decrease. And then I was finally able to stand up and move around and walk without searing pain. And at that point, because I had been exposed to Brazil back in the year 2000, and I had fallen in love with percussion and the idea of dancing, even though I couldn't really do it, because down there, they just dance, they dance, they dance. They dance like we play pickup basketball. I remember driving by gas stations at 11 p.m. in the city of Salvador, Bahia in Brazil. And they have their trunks open, blasting music, dancing. They just dance everywhere. And I was like, well, that's a great way to meet girls, first of all. I don't have to talk to them. I can just ask them to dance. So that was one motivation. But it just struck me how dancing was so natural for them. Like, we play basketball or pick up baseball, whatever it's going to be. And yet how I was growing up, we never danced. It was just, we didn't do it. And we didn't think we could. And that was a big inhibition of mine, was that, well, I'm not a dancer because I look a certain way. That's not what I can do. Of course,
or you're raised a certain way, or
environmental
norms that we live with.
Absolutely. I didn't live with music that was danceable. Rock music is not danceable. So, you know, so once I started to dance a little bit before my dad died, I had started to take lessons, and the teacher, my main teacher, said, you know, you're really good at this and we think you'd be a great teacher. Would you be interested in pursuing this as you know, at least a second job? And I was kind of shocked, but I had already kind of started on that path a little bit. And then about 6 months after my dad died, I just had like this nervous breakdown. Like, I could not do this IT stuff anymore. And I put my 2 weeks in, quit, and just kind of set out on the unknown path.
Well, and here you are in Barnes & Noble picking up a pre-dance, pre-movement type workbook.
Yeah.
Take us into what that kind of introduction of dancing and your time in Brazil and movement, how did that ultimately lead to more of your interests in movement in general? Did you start then with instructing dance lessons? Maybe, you know, a good tangent to that would be, you know, you're still dealing with all of these quote pain syndromes, whether it be SI joint or your neck tension, tinnitus.
Yeah.
Kind of walk us into the next phase of your professional journey and where that interest took you.
So I was immediately fascinated by the connection between loosening up my hips and my foot pain going away. I mean, now it makes perfect sense. But back then it was like, I wasn't a trainer. Most trainers aren't going to see a connection if they don't understand patterns. But the fact that I'm pretty good at seeing patterns and linking things together, like cause and effect. And the fact that my feet started to get better once I opened up my hips, that was really my first foray into the training world. So I started reading religiously about training. And one thing about me is when I get into something, when it catches my interest, I go all in, and you can't pull me away from it. So I just started, like, I would read everything on Mark Versteegen's ancient website, everything he wrote, I read everything on T-Nation, Testosterone Nation, which was big back in the day. I don't know if it still is, but, and some very well-known trainers strength coaches got their start writing for T-Nation. I read everything they wrote about movement and posture and weightlifting and everything. So, and then eventually I got into training and I got my ACE certification first, and then I got the CSCS. So it was that really that link between the feet and the hips, which was the initial, oh, that's interesting. Because all the information before that was just bodybuilding magazines.
Yeah.
Which are BS, obviously.
Well, it's kind of a fun side story is, we just had Jennifer Smart on a week or so ago. And one of the cool things about her and about what you just mentioned, you know, connecting, let's call it hip mobility to plantar fasciitis is someone like you and someone like her and anyone, I should say most people or a lot of individuals within the PRI community, there's a point in time where you start recognizing these connections and these, you know, what we look at as patterns. But again, as I mentioned with Jennifer Smart, this was well before you even knew anything about PRI or any of our science.
Right.
So I think there's a common denominator among a lot of our clinicians and providers and people within the PRI community is that at a certain point in your own journey, you start to see things from either a different viewpoint, a holistic viewpoint, or literally in your case, it's just one connection. It just takes one connection for someone to say, okay, my hip is related to my heel.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of a cool, you know, the more, and I know you have talked to many, many, many other like-minded individuals out there. And it's really almost across the board that people have that aha moment in their own life where
they have to.
Yeah.
And, otherwise, they'll never get it.
Yeah. And eventually, somehow, they find PRI. And I want to kind of take us into that conversation, Neil. After you have this foundation of interest, movement interest, your own personal movement, trying to get to that Brazilian flow that you saw that you're interested in dance.
Yeah.
What was your first exposure to this science? And how did you, I know when your course history began and you dove into kind of becoming more interested in learning and providing the science in general. But I know some of your story and I know your history with, you know, your own dysfunction that you already kind of highlight a little bit, you know, whether it was neck tension or tinnitus or any other issue that you were trying to on your own figure out, look at and quote fix. What was it? Or how did you first find PRI from a personal journey?
I had read about them. I had read about PRI on Eric Kresse's website.
Okay.
And however, he talked about breathing. And of course, I was so muscle-minded back then, weightlifting back then, that I was like, who cares about that? You know, what's that going to do for me? What am I going to learn from that? Even though he was like, this is the best money I've spent in 5 years of education. Like, was this one class because he saw like shoulder internal rotation change with one breath? I don't know, something along those lines. And so I was like, well, all right, whatever. And I'm not gonna lie, your dad didn't look like a weightlifter. So I wasn't really interested. So it's like, what's he gonna teach me? So so later on, but it stayed in my mind. And then I heard that I had read some other people writing about PRI. But again, back then it still wasn't that out there. It was still minor mentions, if anything, because I don't think anyone really understood it. But then eventually, I found myokinematic restoration on the CSCS continuing education website. And I was like, oh, there's that PRI thing again. But this time it wasn't about breathing. Well, I mean, it wasn't about breathing. It was the myokin course. And I was like, lumbar? Got that. Hip, got that. Femur, that's probably an issue. It's like, I have, and at that time I was stuck in this mean lateral pelvic tilt. after, because it was about 7 or 8 months after I had just one of the most intense back spasms of all time, where I couldn't get off the ground for 2 days. It was horrible. And it left me in this tilted pelvis position, and I could not get out of it. And so when I saw that on the site, I was like, well, I mean, I know I have these issues, so let me just take this. And then so it was James Anderson teaching it. And within the first 10 minutes of him describing, I mean, this is how I remember it, whether it's exactly how this was, I'm not sure, but you know, human memory is what it is. And this is what my memory is. Within 10 minutes of him describing the typical left AIC patient, I was like, this is it. You have two diaphragms? What? Asymmetric pelvis position? What? Like, why is this not being spoken about? Why is this some sort of secret?
You couldn't escape the breathing respiration concept. Like, okay, it's not just about breathing. I'll take this course. And then he talks about breathing.
Yeah, but I still, you know, I was still so focused on the pelvis. I understood the musculature of the pelvis. I did not understand the musculature of the rib cage and the diaphragms. I just knew that once you said asymmetric pelvis and asymmetry, I was sold. I didn't understand the breathing part. It took me years to understand the breathing part. But then the next day I went to the gym and I understood that if your legs are positioned in a compensatory way because of a patterned pelvis above it, that part of it is reversing what those legs are doing. And so I went into a trap bar deadlift bar, switched my feet around. And this was no left heel and right arch at that point, because I was way beyond what
this
I
was just like placement. Anyway,
yeah, all I did was place my feet opposite of what a left AIC position leg would be in, basically. And I deadlifted, you know, 90 pounds. Probably not the best way to reposition the pelvis, but damn it, it worked. My right glute kicked in, my left hamstring kicked in, and I could not believe how free my pelvis felt. To the point that when I was walking out of the gym, I kept stopping, because to me, it felt like my hips, I felt like Gisele Bündchen walking down a catwalk in a modeling show with those, you know, hips swinging side to side in that exaggerated walk. That's what I felt like. Yet all I really was feeling was a normally moving pair of hips, which I had I had never felt that in my life.
Yeah.
So that was my introduction to peer eye and why nothing.
And as you mentioned earlier, we'll get into your deep dive. And I know you've been kind of on the journey ever since, but one of the things that's interesting is you probably, not only did you go to that trap bar and try it on yourself, but as you know, for many people, it just takes one. For you, it was the introduction to a left AIC, which is like day one, first 2 hours of my, you know, it's early on in the Myokin course.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you just build and build and build off of that one concept. Mm-hmm. For you, I know hundreds of people that probably contact you. That is a common, you know, it's not just like, okay, I think I have this pattern that this guy is talking about.
Right.
It's the same thing for so many people that find this institute, is you start to realize that, okay, I'm not all that different. You know, you probably felt like you were really special, like, okay, I'm in this pattern, this fits me.
Yeah.
And then you start looking around, and that's kind of where I was going with this, is you go to a gym or you go to that gym setting and you're like, wait a minute, that guy looks the same way. And that girl over there has the same forward, you know, she's standing in the same stance that I just tried to get out of. And you start to realize that you're not so uniquely problematic as you thought you were.
No, that's what you want to really get across to people, because they think there's something really wrong with them, because they can accurately describe what's going on in their body in a certain way. They know they're twisted and they know what they're feeling. They just can't describe it appropriately. And they try to tell a doctor or maybe another physical therapist who doesn't understand PRI or never been exposed to it, and they're told they're crazy. Yeah, and yet they are accurately described, and the validation they receive when I can say, oh yeah, that's exactly what's going on.
Well, and you can kind of chime in as again, you've seen and talked to and consulted with so many people. But for me, Neil, that's one of the most you know, satisfying and gratifying moments when people have that same exact feeling you did after that first Myokin course. And as you said, it's really a empowering feeling because you're told over and over and over again about the dysfunction you have, the problems you have, the whatever diagnosis that you might have been labeled with. And then finally you realize that, okay, I'm okay. I'm a human being. I'm acting as a normal human being. Yeah, this is not unique to me. Other people feel the same way I do. And it just is such a start point for really the journey that we see so many people on. And, you know, what I want to kind of take from that is once you started to, again, that was kind of your foundation and kind of your aha moment as an individual and realizing that some of these patterns do fit your presentation. Mm-hmm. Where'd you go from there?
Where did I go from there? I just went all in. I was still training people and I was teaching every night. So I was teaching dancing every night by that point. I was still, after that, I never had another SI joint blowout. So even from the time I started teaching dancing until for at least 3 or 4, maybe into 5 years into it, there would still be 3 or 4 times a year where either a neck spasm or SI joint issue would just keep me out for a week. Like it would just flare up and I wouldn't be able to do a thing. But then once I did that first trap bar deadlift, I never had another SI joint blowout or neck spasm again. Now I was not out of the woods by any sense, but just repositioning the pelvis. And then I went to do a knee towards knee and I thought my adductor was going to tear off my bone because I don't think I ever used my left adductor before. You know, it, even though I had so many issues that I had to deal with, which I was completely unaware of, the improvement was so great. So I just knew there was something there that I just had to keep going, you know, as far into it as possible, even though I understood so little. And that's the important thing to realize for people. You know, you understand so little in the beginning. And the amount of times I would leave a seminar and just want to go crazy. Like I'd sit down with the manual and I get home just pulling my hair out. Ribcage mechanics, my God, I could not understand ribcage mechanics and what the serratus did and the lower trap and all this other stuff. So I just went all in, even though I realized I didn't understand any of it, a lot of it, you know, but I just, something was there and I just had to go more into it. There was nothing else I could do. Let's put it that way.
Well, and again, another common denominator with so many individuals involved with our institute and that take our coursework is that, you know, I think you're really the embodiment of this type of conversation, but learning it to understand your own body and really the fact that so many of our, you know, course attendees and providers and even those that are interested in their own bodies start with that same exact sequence. You know, we all, and again, it comes back to our discussion of like, we're all human. We all live we're all built asymmetrically. Mm-hmm. And we're all living in worlds where that's just driven further by what we do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. You started in IT work, you know, quickly realized that it wasn't going to be beneficial for your body. And
I didn't make that connection. I didn't know that that's what was causing it. I mean, it wasn't the only thing causing it, but I didn't realize at the time that how detrimental it was.
Yeah. Well, and again, like you said, it's not like that was the only cause of what you're experiencing. We all live. Yeah. We all live lives.
It was the ice.
We all go to work. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just so happens you're also, for anyone that I didn't really mention this in the beginning, Neil, but you reside in New Jersey and you're quite frequently, I think it's safe to say that you're frequent traveler in New York. You know, you're in a place of high autonomic tension.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you know, it's so interesting for people that come to us or come to you or come to our providers from these highly driven lives, whether it be New York City, the city really doesn't matter. Your point in location isn't all that matters, but the people that are the most autonomically driven or dysautonomic, for that matter, are the individuals that, you know, live these lives of constant increased environmental stressors.
It's lack of
periphery, lack of space.
How the testing of someone living in Manhattan will be different than the testing of the majority of people. If drive 20 minutes west into New Jersey and you'll find different testing. I don't think I've ever found a non-PEC, like complete, not like PEC, like strong PEC. I don't think I've ever tested in someone in New York who wasn't just really strongly PEC. I mean, I just don't think it's happened.
Again, I'm not singling out these locations, but you can literally almost pinpoint areas of the country, the world, internationally. All you have to do is ask someone where they're from, what they do for a living.
Yeah.
You know, are they in an apartment in Manhattan? Do they have space around them? All these concepts that we'll get into later as far as what you're going to be working on with the symposium. But it's just amazing to, once you recognize these patterns and once you have that experience of actually living them, it's just reaffirming to know, okay, yes, this is normal. Once again, like, I'm a product of my environment.
Yeah.
I'm not inherently built to fail. It's because of the processing and the environment around me. We could go on for hours on just that alone.
Yeah, one thing about that, I think it's important when you, like, I don't even like to talk about patterns anymore because I don't want people thinking they are something because they get so caught. I think I'm this dreaded left AIC pattern or this dreaded PEC. So I try to get it across to them that we're just talking about tension.
Yeah.
Don't worry about what pattern you are because underneath we're all the same.
Or let's look at your positioning underneath that pattern. You know, let's not even take it to the pattern and the diet and the label. You know, we talked earlier.
It's a diagnosis. If they don't understand, they think it's a diagnosis. Oh my God, I'm a left AIC. Oh my God, there's something really wrong with me. You know?
Yeah. And that is, you know, we often, when I say we, I mean the PRI community and the therapist, you know, the providers out there, but so many times you have to realize that just how you start that interaction with your clients, the verbiage you use, and there's so many great people that I could mention that do a fascinating, you know, job of just realizing you're already setting someone up to fail the minute you label them with whatever it may be.
Yeah.
It just so happens left AIC isn't that bad. Like that's one of the better, you know, that's like, manage this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just one of those things where you have to come at it from a patient perspective, which is so cool about you is because you were in that chair. You were that patient.
Yeah.
And realizing that, you know, let's not label you, let's not diagnose you with another quote issue.
Right.
This is a normal positional, again, we don't want to use it's a pattern, but you have to introduce it to them as a way of life, a way of positioning that they're carrying themselves through space.
Yeah.
And I think you're awesome at that because of your own journey.
And sometimes, and I don't do a perfect job of it, I can tell you that. I mean, there's so many things you're trying to communicate to a client or patient that sometimes you do use the wrong language. And it's like a little bit later, like, oh, I probably shouldn't have said that word. But it's not always simple to get across what you need to get across without them taking it in a
personal level,
in a fearful way, in a way that causes fear of some type.
Yeah.
So it's always a fine line. And some people don't care. You can say whatever you want. It just rolls off their back. They're just like, hey, fine. Yeah. Whatever the issue, just let me know. Other people, they get real, real worried about every little thing. And
it's, again, it's all because of their past and their, the reason why they're there with you in the first place. You touched on something earlier, Neil, about when I asked you, where'd you go from there? Well, I went all in. One of the things I think you probably commonly see with your clientele, and we'll get into a little bit later on your setting and how you operate, but just based on that comment of, you know, fear and diagnosis and labeling, I think a common thing that you see and that all of our providers see is people often, they pinpoint it down to a pattern. They're in this left AIC, or in your case, in a lot of instances, a PEC and maybe a bilateral PEC, and maybe they've got some other issues going on underneath that. Do you personally see a point at which, and I know, again, I'm kind of trying to tie this into your personal journey. Mm-hmm. At what point do you find for other people and during your own kind of journey for yourself that you realize, okay, there are these baseline patterns. This is the position in space that I'm in. Mm-hmm. I'm addressing this, but yet I still have neck tension. I still maybe have tinnitus from time to time. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, my hip flexor flares up. I know you personally, and again, it's not the point of this conversation, is all the other integration that you've gone through as far as visual acuity and spatial awareness. But do you find a point in quote treatment where people kind of get that baseline of understanding of their patterns they're in, mm-hmm. but yet you as your own individual and with many of your clients, there comes a point where, okay, you're at a point where you're not progressing. Mm-hmm. You still are showing, you know, you're still falling back into these patterns from time to time. At what point did you yourself kind of realize that you had other issues going on? Maybe your visual system was at play. Maybe you had some occlusal issues that, you know, and maybe you don't, maybe your clients don't. But at what point do you take them to that next step of integration beyond just positioning of their pelvic floor, their hip, their heels, their.
Yeah. So, well, for myself, from my own experience, at first I thought it was all about the pelvis. And then I took, you know, postural respiration and pelvis restoration.
Yep.
Yeah. And it was at pelvis restoration. I remember Lori was the teacher, and it was in Connecticut, and I drove up to Connecticut. And I remember we were doing a PRI wall supported reach, and everyone else is doing it, and they're all feeling their quads, and they're feeling their legs are trembling, and I'm doing it, and I'm like, well, I'm either really strong, and this is nothing, like this is just so not challenging for me, or something's off, because I felt nothing, and I literally felt nothing, and everyone else is like shaking and feeling their quads, and Lori's like, your quads should be having a party right now. Like, I feel nothing in my quads, and so I asked her after the class. I don't really remember what I asked her, but she looked at my face, which was very torsioned, and she kind of said, "You might need to take the neck course." I guess I think she called it Cervical Revolution. I don't know. I think she said, "I was like, a neck course? Are you kidding me? Now there's a neck course? I didn't know that there was a neck course," and so I looked it up. So at that point, I was like, "All right, fine." And then at impingement and instability, I asked your father about my crossbite. Oh no, about my the ring in my ears, and he looked. Of course, he's always looked. I swear, every time before I got to know him really well, but I kept seeing him at seminars because I kept taking them, and I think he finally got to see my face enough and my torsioned face, and he's like, "Well, you know, that crossbite might have something to do with it. Come to Cervical Revolution next time I'm in New York, and we'll see what we can do." And so he used me as a torsion example, and Dan was there, Sean Light was there, Donna Parisi, that's her last name, right? Yeah, she was there, and he used me as an example of a torsion, and he put that cheap plastic mount. So he tested me, my pelvis, I think my pelvis may have been neutral. That was the good thing. But shoulder tests, fail, neck didn't budge. Of course, I was unaware of any of this stuff because I wasn't really in that much pain anymore. I had issues, but I wasn't in constant physical pain. That was the important thing. I was no longer in chronic pain. So that was the biggest thing to me. But he put the mouth guard in between my teeth and had me walk around the room. And when I got up off the table, I put one foot down. And then when I went to put the other foot down, I basically just stumbled. I almost fell down. And then I walked around the room and I was just woozy and just discombobulated. And that was my realization that there was something going on that was way beyond just muscle. And then the next day we did the actual repositioning, the standing cervical, not the standing cranial repositioning, alternating repositioning. And you know, after that, again, I was like really just out of it. Now I thought that was the normal response that everyone would have. I thus learned afterwards that I had a very strong response, probably because I was patterned for so long, and probably also because I still had this visual system that wasn't working properly, which I did not know about. But that was really the big difference. I started to actually feel the ground underneath my feet differently. So grounding actually meant something after that, because I would hear those words and they were so abstract. Like, oh, this person can't ground. They can't sense things. I'm like, I don't know who these people are. I can sense everything, right? And then when I'm actually feeling the ground underneath my feet differently, it's like, oh my God, this is like everything. I just didn't understand what he was saying, but now I do. And then I realized, but we didn't do a technique. Like I didn't lift any weights. I didn't strengthen a hamstring. I didn't really try to find an adductor or a glute to make these changes occur. We just took away sensory input that was preventing these things from occurring. And so I still didn't understand it, but my consciousness had changed. And I was no longer thinking of this as a muscular issue per se. I was thinking of it more in terms of sensory and energy. Let's put it that way.
Well, and Neil, to kind of change the perception or dialogue a little bit towards how you see that from a provider standpoint with your clients, many of them, again, do take the courses and they're on that same journey for their own awareness.
Yeah.
But do you see, again, you know, the one thing about PRI is test, retest. We have tests for every pattern and position and every course you're in. Yeah. But beyond test results and beyond testing with your clients, who in today's world, many are virtual anyways, you're not there physically doing a cervical axial rotation test.
Right.
But do you see that people have a similar point in time where, again, they kind of get the whole patterned positional muscular mm-hmm. dynamics of everything you've mm-hmm. gone through with them? How do you, in our virtual lives, and we'll get into after this discussion kind of a lot of your integrative consultation and how you really quote treat and see patients, but how do you go to that point in time with people that you're not necessarily testing directly you know, how do you get them to feel that sensory awareness or lack thereof that you felt in that cervical class in New York when they're not physically with you?
References. I mean, left stance. So the first thing I do with people is I ask them what they're feeling underneath their feet. And the vast majority are going to say, I'll lead them a little bit, you know, underneath your left foot, you feel towards the heel or towards the forefoot. Most people are going to say, you know, towards the arch of the left foot and then the heel of the right foot and outside on the right foot. Most people are going to say that. So, and I point that out. I was like, isn't it interesting that you're not feeling the ground underneath your feet in the same spot? I'm like, oh, okay. So then I'll get them into left stance, or maybe I'll start them with right stance if they're not really in a lot of pain. If they're in a lot of pain, I'm probably not going to put them into right stance because it might just exacerbate their pain. But you know, it just depends on the person. But then I'll get them into left stance and have them feel what it's like to be in left stance. And they'll compare, how do you feel in right stance compared to left stance? And that's another seed in their mind. Like, whoa, this is a different experience. They feel unsteady on their left side. And if they feel too steady on their left side, they're cheating. And I know they are. So then you start to maybe move their eyes around a little bit or make sure their knee is not locked. And then they unlock and now they become very, very unsteady. And they
have that same discombobulate. You know,
Similar. So if they're saying, no, I feel really steady on that left side, maybe they're not really on their left side and their pelvis is still turned to the right. Maybe they're using their eyes to hold them up. Maybe their knee is locked. Maybe they're too arched. So you got to really play with their positioning a little bit. And then they start to wobble a little bit. And then they realize, whoa, I'm really unstable when they're truly in what's more closely resembles left stance.
Yeah.
So, and the other big thing is I test people because it's so much of it's online. So I'll use a 90-90 as an evaluation. And I always make sure that they recognize that once they're in a position, their ability to feel a muscle will depend on what they're sensing from that wall underneath their feet or the floor underneath their back. And by manipulating those sensory inputs, we can give them a muscle or take away a muscle because they're not moving at that point. And I make it really, I really strive to get that across to them. Did I ask you to feel your left hamstring at any point? And the answer will be no. I'm backdooring that muscle by having them sense other areas of their body, you know, what they're lying on, what they're pushing into, and which the position of their body. And that is what allows them to feel that muscle. That's something that's a huge
benefit.
Yeah. So they stop thinking about it as just tell me what exercise to do.
Yeah. Or
make me stronger. Just because it requires, especially online, it requires a change of consciousness. It really does. Yep.
Well, and you probably get this all the time as well. And I know us at the Institute, you know, we do these workshops, these non-manual technique workshops, and really within every course, we go over some form of technique pretty much. But one of the main, most common questions is, do you ever have people do this on the other side? Mm-hmm. And just what you're saying is, well, sometimes you have to go to the quote easy side. And again, if someone's very patterned and they already have pain on the right side, you're not going to take them there. Mm-hmm. But so much of what we do is targeted. We're targeting specific muscles. We're targeting you to feel just what you said. You're not asking them to feel the left hamstring, but they're going to tell it to you when they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's one of the things I think that some new to PRI providers, or maybe you're coming at it, you know, as a new exposure, you're not quite as far along in the journey, but it's one of the things that I think is so important for those people to understand is give them their easy side, give them their pattern side, have them sense and feel and really take in what it feels like to be on that right side before you go then into your training on the left. Mm. It's one of those things where do you start? What do you cue them with? Again, we talked earlier about one misspoken word may turn the whole treatment into the wrong direction. And you can only control so much, but what are you asking of them and what are they telling you just because you asked that? Like, you don't want to say, do you feel your left heel? They're just going to say, well, yeah, I think I do.
Yeah.
But
you know, that left heel should be associated with something else. So you know, if they're truly feeling their left heel, they'll also be feeling certain muscles. So you have to make, but it took me, I could not have done online even 3 years ago. Yeah. You know, it took that understanding of the fact that I know what they should feel in every technique. And if they're not feeling it, it's because not because they have to work harder, it's because they haven't inhibited. And, you know, and once they truly inhibit and maybe put in less effort or use references properly, those muscles will turn on unless there's something cranially
going on. Unless this other compensation.
Yeah, and that's obviously the most difficult part of online is.
Yep. Well, and I think again, with your own journey and with so many of our providers, until you're at that point of understanding the details of each reference center and what they should be feeling with each technique, you don't necessarily want to go to a further technique until you're ready to take them there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just going to be harder. It's not going to,
they
have to, it's no different than dancing in the sense that, you know, there's fundamental movements and positions involved in PRI. They need to, and in dancing, all the fancy stuff in dancing is just the fundamentals dressed up, you know, and sometimes, and with PRI techniques, the more complicated techniques are really still going to involve the same fundamental movements of left AFIR, left COA, and then torso rotation and using sensory integration. So, but if you want to really get them to understand that it's not about the amount of techniques, they got to learn these basic techniques. And the better they can internalize the movements, you know, the better it, the more difficult techniques are going to come easier because they know what the positions are.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned a lot of your online involvement. I want to kind of ask you about just to, you know, for our listeners to kind of get an understanding of how you clinically practice and what clientele you see. You know, we mentioned a large passion of yours with dance and You can walk us through maybe a little bit of your past history with instructing that, and kind of how your story has come full circle from that first time you got asked to instruct a dance class. And now today, you know, you have done so successfully for quite a while. But walk us through, you know, you mentioned something that 3 years ago, you don't necessarily feel like you could have gone to such an online format.
Right.
Within the past year, I think a large portion of everyone listening has had to some way or the other incorporate virtual consultation, telehealth, communicating as we are today,
right,
and being able to look at sensory awareness, body position on a screen versus in front of you in person.
Right.
But maybe kind of segue that into how PRI helps you on an online format, how some of those quote lower numbered, easier techniques, if you can get someone to understand those and properly get in those positions, you know, you mentioned that the more integrative ones will follow, but how has that implementation of PRI helped you on an online format? And then kind of walk us into, you know, your current setting, how you see patients. And again, you mentioned earlier that you're doing probably getting back to a lot more in-person clients.
Sure,
walk us through a little bit of your setting and how you use PRI, not only on an online basis, but also just in general with your in-person clients.
Well, really, people really find me just for PRI these days. I'm not really into training, like strength training or physical training. I don't really do any of that anymore. I had a little crisis of confidence or consciousness when I realized so much of the stuff that's done in strength and conditioning can be quite non-beneficial for lots of people. And so once I really started understanding these patterns, I was like, well, how the heck am I going to, take what I know now back to the weight room? This was before the PRI integration for, you know, training. I can't remember the name of the seminar.
Before the fitness course. Yeah.
Yeah. That was before this came out. So, you know, I'm thinking, right, how do I mesh these two together? I started to use left heel and right arch during exercises. And I remember I had this aha moment when I was training someone one day and they were doing a TRX row and her right elbow would hurt every time she would pull. I said, let's try something. And all I do, I had her unlock her knees, sense left heel, right arch. And I just had her bring her left shoulder down a little bit, her left side down a little bit. And she rode, no pain. I was like, oh my God, is that like that little bit of a difference could be the difference between pain and not pain. And so I realized, wait a minute, this can be done. You can just start to bias every single exercise you do with somebody to make up for that internal bias that wants to make us use our right side naturally. And, you know, you're probably going to, for a lot of people, they're going to benefit from slightly biasing that left hemisphere, the left side of their body, using references and position. And so that's when I realized you can do this. But in terms of training, you know, so that's really all I do at this point is mostly PRI, both online and in person. That's what people are finding me for. So that's really what I do. And my interest really isn't in strength training anymore. So.
And Neil, in relation to kind of where we're going to take this conversation, I'm going to pull Ron in a second, but getting back to, again, how you started with movement through dance, I think we all have outlets of interest where it's just naturally a passion of yours because of your history, but how has dance allowed you to, you know, from the instructional level and from the classes you've, you know, been a part of and introduced to others. We talked briefly before we started that, again, I always have this bug in my head that most of what you do is salsa based or salsa like dance styles. But how has that, I'm going to use the word freedom of movement, through dance, allowed you not only to share some of these concepts, but also for yourself, just keep that rhythm alive within what you do? And how do you use dance to help others?
Well, I started notice the interesting thing is back when I did not understand anything, And, you know, one issue with your father is that sometimes he speaks in language that people are not understanding. I was drawn to that because I have a kind of philosophical way of viewing the world. And so he would speak in these terms and I was like, hey, this is like dancing. This is like salsa, like leading and following. Like you have to, when you're learning to dance with a partner, there can only be one leader and there can only be one follower. If you don't, you just collide and nothing works. You freeze up, nothing's gonna work. So I was always putting things, I was understanding PRI from a partner dancing salsa perspective and how each side has to play with each other. Like you have to be able, the leader has to lead, but then give up control at times. And the follower has to follow. And sometimes the follower, if you've danced, you know, the follower doesn't always want to follow. They will sometimes want to lead. And so this idea of two, and that's going to be a big part of my presentation, that you have two sides, that you have two personalities, you have two, every two must be included. And so that was one of the things that really, that helped me understand PRI from a broad perspective, even though, again, I still didn't know what the serratus did. I didn't know how to get frontal plane movement of the ribs. I didn't understand all that, but I started to understand it more from that philosophical aspect and tension management. And the other part was I would notice things in dancing because there's something called Latin motion, and which I'm going to teach on the second day, or at least the basics of it. But Latin motion is the particular way that hips and rib cages have to move during Latin dancing that gives it that style. And you would, first of all, it's really hard to do. It was the hardest thing to learn how to do is what's called Latin motion. But once I did learn it and I started teaching it, which is hard to teach, you start to notice that there's restrictions. Some people can't get their pelvis to move properly. And through PRI seminars, I started realizing I'm just seeing the left AIC pattern in action. They can't shift their pelvis to the left. So they can't get that pelvis to move rhythmically from side to side. They cannot separate their snowballs. They have no ability to move their hips and shoulders in a dynamic triplanar way without their head going with it. They can't separate those. So I started to see the connections. And then the big thing was grounding. Again, like everything is about grounding to me. Everything to me comes back to grounding. And I noticed that when people look funky, for lack of a better word, with their dancing and their motion, they can't push the ground. They do not know how to use the ground to move their body. And so they lock out their knees and they look really herky jerky. And this is well known in dancing that you have to learn how to push. So dance teachers are doing PRI without knowing, because PRI is just an explanation of life, of how humans move and interact with the atmosphere and the universe around us and the ground underneath our feet and gravity. So we are doing PRI without realizing it. And PRI is doing dancing without realizing, because it's just movement. It's just natural human movement that we've lost. So I've always been putting PRI in dance perspectives. And then 2 years ago, Ron asked me about presenting, and well, he didn't really ask me, he kind of just said, you're presenting. And I said, okay. And so that was, it came full circle, as we said, like, who knew? I 8 years ago, I was like, I don't understand anything they're talking about. And then, 8 years later, here I am, which is kind of mind blowing to me.
Well, and it's, you mentioned these dancers that kind of, they may lead with one hip and their neck may follow, or they may.
Yeah.
And it's that, it goes back to that one side you mentioned with dance, the concept of two, and there's a leader and a follower. Yeah. And I know Ron's talked about probably virtually in every course, we could count the number of times he says hemi or bi or two.
Yeah.
It would be thousands by now, but
yeah.
It's really a part of everything we do. You called it a leader and a follower. You could call it a pusher, as you mentioned with dance, people learning how to push.
Yeah.
But coincidentally, you have to then pull, there's push and pull and lead and follow and inhibition versus activate. But
compression. So in dancing, if you're dancing with a partner, you have to have a certain amount of compression, as we call it. Your arms and your body, you can't be too limp, but you can't be too tight. You have to find that happy medium.
And so then you also have to sense it from your partner.
Yeah, otherwise you won't feel a thing. Or your partner won't. You can't, you cannot transmit what you want to do to your partner unless they can feel your body. And without the proper compression or the frame, as we call it, it's not going to happen. So that compression, like even that term compression, I was like, oh my God, this is just like the compression you have to give, alternating compression. And it's just that give and take, that pull and pull and push. It was all, it allowed me to understand it in a way that I wouldn't have if I if I hadn't been dancing.
Well, and while we're on the subject, Neil, I think it'd be a good time to pull Ron in.
Sure.
And we'll get kind of some more background on how you guys came about some of these topics you'll be discussing and get into both of your guys' perspectives on these two topics and the symposium as a whole. So I'll go grab him, Neil.
Okay,
Neil. Well, I pulled Ron in and we're joined now by Ron Horuska and really excited to talk a little bit more specifically about your upcoming presentations as part of our basal ganglia disease symposium on April 22nd and 23rd. You know, we just got done talking a lot about the influence of dance on your personal journey and in relation to anyone on the PRI journey and how the two go really hand in hand. We talked about two, pushing and pulling and a leader versus a follower with any dance choreography that you've done. Mm-hmm. One thing we didn't talk about, well, I guess you briefly talked about it, but your first topic and your first discussion as part of that symposium on day one is really a cool title, Neil. I actually really like the title is Inhibiting Inhibitions and Rediscovering Your Innate Alternating Rhythms Through Dance. Talk to us before we kind of get Ron's perspective on, you know, your involvement and the topic as a whole. Give us a little bit of your perspective, Neil, on how you came, not necessarily how you came up with the title, but what inhibiting already inhibition means to you, what inhibiting inhibitions mean from you in relation to this presentation.
What I was getting at with the title was the fact that we become inhibited, meaning we stop doing things, we stop moving, our mental activity stops going towards something that we would like to do because of events in life. And for a lot of people, it's at a young age. It could be the teenage years. That I think that happens with a lot of people, middle school years, teenage years, where you as a developing ego-centered human become restricted because of bullying, teasing, a father figure or someone who has some sort of power over you, a teacher. You're in standard classes instead of advanced classes. Tracking in school, someone says you're not the proper height to play this sport, or it could be some completely innocuous comment that you take in a certain way because you process this comment in a certain way that then inhibits you. And I think we become inhibited through life because of these experiences. But if you could, and then it prevents us from doing things we really want to do. And a lot of times there's an associated emotion or strong feeling with these inhibitions that go along with it that then reinforce the inhibition. And when you start to feel your own physiology reacting to a situation, it simply reinforces what you're already thinking, this negative experience of yourself. You say, see, I can't do it. You know, for any guy, the experience of trying to approach a woman can often be very, very difficult. And if you feel rejection and it stings, and this happens in dancing, this is a huge issue in dancing. Guys are terrified to ask a girl to dance because of that fear of rejection. And the females don't understand it. Like, what's so hard about it? Until I have my female students ask guys to dance. And if they get rejected, then they understand what that pain really is. And it is intense pain. And if you can't interpret it correctly and reframe it as maybe she was tired, maybe, you know, her foot hurt, maybe it wasn't just about, because you take the rejection personally, like there must be something wrong with me. And again, it just reinforces this inhibition. And I think a lot of these life experiences, once you already have this idea, I can't do this. And then every time you come close to doing it, you start to feel the tension again, your physiologic tension, and you identify it with, oh, there's something wrong. and you back away again, and you get stuck from, you get prevented from doing what you really want to do. And I know a lot of people would love to dance. I don't care what nationality you are. There are so many different people. And so for some nationalities, it's even harder because it's part of their culture. And they think, well, if I can't do it, I must just stink. And well, I'm not going to make a fool of myself. And I should know how to do this just automatically. And it can be hard for them also. So people want to learn how to dance. They want to go, they want to be at a party and not just sit at a table and drink the whole time. They'd rather dance, but they're too afraid to do it because they think they have to be something special. They just can't get over that hurdle, that inhibition that has been there for so long. And what I'm really wanting to do is bust that myth that they can't do it.
From my perspective, Neil, the opportunity for the attendee to hear you present ways to break that inhibition down is going to help those individuals understand, with patients who do not have a fear of asking someone to dance, but have a fear to ask themselves to move their limbic system, their appendages, because of the similarities in what you just described in a social situation is going on in a cortical situation, where the pathway that's been established through the use of hormones or lack of have resulted in this degree, in this, I might say, intense degree to inhibit tone, tension, tremors, tics. That's what this basal ganglia extrapyramidal discussion is going to be all about. So having someone like you show how to resolve that or move through with suggestions on how to actually implement leg movement, for example, is the same kind of discussion we need to have with those individuals who have fears that are similar, but for different physiological, chemical reasons. Uh-huh. That's neuro, but uh-huh. not so much neuro based on social concerns, emotional concerns, other psychological avenues. These are physiological avenues that are very what? Very, very similar. And so when I listen to you talk, the person who attends this conference will learn that the very same things you're trying to get your students to do, we should all be trying to be mindful of, that we have this, that they also are experiencing similar situations with patients and clients that have a genuine fear, a genuine sense of inability to do something if they're not encouraged to do it in a certain manner or a certain way.
Well, and Neil, I think, again, the cool thing about you is your whole story that we just got done discussing, this really was you. You even were asked to instruct the dance, and you're at a level where you're just trying to learn to re-dance, if you will.
Yeah.
And we talked earlier about, again, that lead versus follow aspect of people that can't even disassociate their shoulder and neck from their lower extremities, or moving your leg one direction while the arm is going in another rotationally through, whether it be salsa or whatever kind of dance you want to discuss. But maybe just mention, and again, this kind of ties us into your next topic, but what do you plan on kind of highlighting as far as extremity movement, or incorporating, let's say, the push with one part of a body and the pull on the other, or a lead half of your body with a following on the other side, as we talked about earlier in the discussion?
Yeah. Well, as I have discussed with Ron, my dancing is just glorified walking, because you're just alternating feet. In most dances, you're alternating feet. Ballroom dances, you're just walking. It's just a walking dance. Latin dances, you're also alternating dances, alternating feet. Sometimes there's a step and a tap, but usually you're just, and that's why the step tap is simply the greatest dance move ever, which I will be teaching, because if you can step and tap, you can be the best dancer at a wedding. And the reality is most people just want to be able to get up and dance at a wedding or a party without feeling stupid, without feeling like they look ridiculous. Of course, no one cares. And that's the other important thing also. No one cares what you look like. No one, everyone is so concerned about themselves, they're not judging you. Only the teachers like me are judging. We're not judging, we're just watching. But you know, learning how to step to the side and then tap with the other foot. Once you put body movement into it, it can look different. So the footwork is, I don't want to say simple, because footwork is hard for the beginner. They have to learn how to move their feet first. But for an experienced dancer, the feet are not the difficulty. The difficulty is the body movement and the arms that create a certain style. There is no difference between Frankie Martinez, who I will show a clip of, and Beyonce, or anyone else that you, or Michael Jackson. The feet are simple for a trained dancer. The feet are not hard. It's the counts, it's the syncopated rhythms, and it's the movement of the body that is the challenge. And that's what makes different dances look different. Because how many different ways are there to walk? You can't, yeah, but yeah, you can walk forward differently in a waltz than you will in a tango. And a dance teacher can identify that there are two different dances by the way that you're walking forward, even though all you're doing is walking forward. So it's the body itself, the pelvic movement, particularly with Latin, but the pelvis, rib cage, and arm movements that make the dance a particular style. The feet are the feet. If you learn the feet first, which you have to, the styling comes on top of it. And then that's what's going to make you look like a good dancer. But the feet are pretty easy to learn, especially for an advanced dancer or for someone who's been doing it for a long time. For a beginner, it's always going to be difficult. And it always starts with the feet. But the feet are not what makes the dancing. It's the style.
Well, you can now see, RJ, why we're so excited to have Neil come and present. Neil's history with this institute goes way back, and I know him personally. And Neil, I'm so excited to have you come to Lincoln for lots of reasons, for everything you just went over, but more importantly, for those people who don't know Neil and you want to know more about rhythmic entrainment or mental choreography that's associated with the same kinds of needs that people with extrapyramidal disorders have, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. We don't get this opportunity every day to have someone like him with his experience. And it's clinically, it's real experience, it's true experience, and then apply to a disorder similar to Parkinson's, someone who has Parkinson's. The one thing that I listen, every time I talk to you, Neil, I always get so revved up, because your dance world is really a personal thing to you. I just hear it in your voice. You're instructing people to do things without instructing them. You have a gift of getting people to envision things and flow through things. And we need that same type of assistance with people who are struggling to overcorrect an overreaction to something, and somebody who can't stop a festinated style of gait movement, which is kind of like a dance. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I want to remind everybody, there's a part of our brain called the medial geniculate. And the medial geniculate is part of this extrapyramidal region that really has a very strong auditory pathway, a very strong beat pathway, a very strong resonance pathway. And it's really an unconscious thing. It's something that we all live on, and that is rhythm. And I know you're going to talk a lot about it. And that's why we are talking about it, because that metronome that's choreographically set into a synaptic pattern of neurological synapses, we need to kind of redirect. And we don't really have to work hard at it if we can get the body to physiologically experience that cortical function that eases the tension and reduces some of the fear that these people have, and this fear of movement itself. So you're going to be a gift. I'm looking forward to it. I think that we're all going to walk away, pardon the pun, with a little bit more beat in our rhythm, a beat in our step. And honestly, that's really one of the biggest ways that Jennifer Smart and I look at, if there's one underlying element to all the clinical treatment programs, it's going to be rhythm. Mm-hmm. It's whether you're boxing or you're kicking or you're swinging an arm, or whether you're just moving yourself in a very oblique, strange manner with a tune that nobody appreciates but you. It's all part of that clinical reasoning behind treatment. So I'm looking forward to it.
One of the things that I personally always get questions about is people that understand the auditory aspect and look for past symposiums or current coursework on auditory relationships to rhythm and movement as we're discussing it. One thing we didn't really get the chance to talk to Jennifer Smart about is this kind of this presentation all three of you will be chiming on together. And I know, Neil, you know, everything you discussed about rhythm starting with the feet and moving on through the arms and rotation of the thorax and everything you'll kind of be discussing through your second presentation from the feet up. Maybe just a couple quick thoughts from either one of you or both of you regarding, again, this second day, tying this all together when all three of you are going to kind of co-present on the effects of auditory rhythm. And I think, Neil, you'll be the first to tell us that every style of dance has a particular style of music associated with the rhythm.
Right.
So how the auditory response and the frequencies associated with that style. And again, I notice, you know, you'll go over particular styles of dance and what they do and how they relate to the movement. But any commentary, again, from either of you, just tying all of this together in relation to the auditory response and how you'll be looking at that in relation to rhythmic movement?
You know, RJ, it's a fair question. And I think the answer to this is, you know, the balance of activity that we sense physically has to also be appreciated by a system inside of us called the amygdala. We like it. Neil, you know what I mean. You want people to enjoy this. They want to be, they want to be happy. They want to be, they want to, it needs to be experiential. You know, it needs to be existence. They need to exist. The existential, existentialism that we're talking about comes from not only the vibration on their skin from a drum or the vibration of their feet on a floor or the tapping of a heel, which we're going to talk about, you know, these heels sense of contact associated with a reinforced beat or vibration that is actually heard reinforces this result in that something made me relax, something put me at ease, and it was fun and it was enjoyable and no one had to ask me. It was immediately experienced. So often these people with Parkinson's have a very flat effect. They can't sense highs and lows. They can't feel when something is good to the eye of a person who's looking at them and not the beholder. They need affirmation. And so what we're talking about in segments like this, RJ, is that's a affirmation, that's afferentation. It's an amygdala that's saying, I like that. I didn't know I could make that kind of a movement, sense it, hear it, feel it with this thing that has a number to it, a beat, a rhythm. And I know, Neil, you're going to talk a lot about that. The timing for these people doesn't even have to be counted, I believe. The timing is just there is a beat and it's heard and it's sensed and it's felt. And I'm pretty sure that's why we put the word down. Balancing music with lateral basal amygdala, the reticular activating system, and the nucleus accumbens is both an emotional and neurological event that's enhancing trust and cooperation from the side of the body or from the other side of the body at a pace that people can identify with because it's their own frequency. Uh-huh. How am I doing, Neil? Am I doing okay with all this?
Yeah, I would just add that from a dancing perspective, you really can't fake dancing in the sense that if you don't like the music, you're not going to want to dance to it. Right. So, you know, I'm going to have examples of different. The good thing about my beginner routine is, well, it's going to satisfy a number of requirements, but it can be done to any type of music except today's hip hop, because today's hip hop is based off trap music from Atlanta in the early 2000s. It's not a regular beat. And that's the weird thing about this. And this is what I think looks kind of strange. Nothing against today's hip hop or the dancing that people do to it, but it's so unregimented. It's not a, there's no natural underlying pulse to the rhythm of this, of a lot of the popular hip hop from today.
Well, I'm glad, I'm glad you said that.
Strange thing.
Because I forced myself to watch every minute of the Grammys last night. Every minute. I wanted to see it all. And when I look at the Grammys, I gotta tell you, I know I'm getting older, and I still like country, and I still like variety of music. Taylor Swift, I love her new album. There were so many awards given to, you know, artists last night that had exactly what you're talking about. Rap, soul is even, you know, soul is even a little different than it used to be in my mind. And then I listened to what they were, I listened to some of the performances, and I think you're right. It's almost like completely a different genre. I don't even know what I would call it. I know what they got the Grammy for, but it's not what I'm used to. It's not what I would be used to.
The style of dance doesn't really have an identity to fit the music. The music, the music is one thing, and the rhythm is a completely separate.
This is how I would explain it. And I went to my good friend who I used to teach for his, if he agreed with me on this, I can appreciate the dancing that's being done, because I was looking it up on YouTube to see how people were dancing these days to today's hip hop. And to me, it looked like in the 80s and 90s, the hip hop had a base. It had this underlying drive, mostly of sound that makes you move to it. Today's music in the hip hop genre, again, nothing against it. It's just the beat is different. And it seems like you have to figure out how to move to this beat rather than having the beat moving you. And some of the Brazilian music that I show, it just drives you. The percussion, it's this rhythmic boom, boom, boom. And it just naturally moves you. And some of today's music, it's like you have to figure, what can I do to this type of beat? Because it's so, it's not regimented, it's not regular. And it's just a type of genre that has become popular. But to me, it doesn't seem like it allows for the same type of rhythmic dancing that we really refer to, or the type of stuff that we prefer people to do. So again, I can't use today's hip hop as an example. I can use Biz Markie from the 90s or any of the 90s hip hop, which I'm going to do. You can use stuff like that because there's a base, a rhythmic, normal, you can count 1-4 without any problem, or 1-2, 1-2 without any problem. Yeah. With today's music, some of that's not really there. You have to figure out, wait, is that the beat? No, is that the beat? Is that the beat? So it's just a different thing.
I know we're going to wrap this up, RJ, but over the last few years, RJ knows that I really, you know, I'm looking for different ways to implement activity in our clinical setting that reflects exactly what you're going to cover in this symposium. Styles. Remember, for the listener, Neil and I have been talking about this now, I want to say over 2.5 years. We had COVID come through last year. And the conversation, Neil, about, I know you and I have talked about Argentina dance. We've talked about African dances. We had some wonderful conversations over the last 2-3 years on this. It's going to be impossible to cover all that in, you know, 2 or 3 hours in a symposium. But for those people who are coming, I think what you're going to learn is that, you know, we're I think on the same page. We need music to move people, and we need beats, and we need metronome type and counting. And whether they count or not, there's got to be a pattern. There's got to be something that they can pattern off of. I just want to tell you, I'm thrilled to death that you're coming. We all are. And we're looking forward to it. For those people who believe that this is going to be only a discussion, like you said, RJ, on something that's boring or something that doesn't pertain to them, you're wrong. This is a symposium that's going to be applicable to every single one of your patients. And if when I say that, every single one of your patients either like music, Neil, or they do not. And that's exactly why you should be coming, right?
And I would, also add that dance steps, if you end it on your right foot, you'll tighten up. If you end it on your left foot, you will relax. And wow. I've done this with three different people.
Wow.
I know they're light. I know that they are not heavily patterned. They're not cranial people. They're easygoing people. So are they patterned? Yeah. Their left leg will never adduct simply because they're never going to do it. But if I get them to do the step and they finish on their left leg, acknowledge their left heel that they're on their left leg, lay them down, they're neutral. So you can inhibit, you can help people. This is a great way for people to keep their body relaxed. They can do it in the morning, they can do it the night, whatever, but just to help inhibit that overactivity of the right side, it can be done, absolutely not for every single person, but for those people who are just plain old left AIC, right BC, if you're thinking from a PRI perspective, you can inhibit that pattern through dancing.
Well, Neil, again, I really thank you for taking time today. One of the things I think at this point in the last two episodes, you know, we had a similar discussion with Jennifer Smart. So many concepts that are overlapping between both of you and everything that Ron will be bringing in to kind of tie the two together. You know, timing, rhythm, arm and leg alternation. Mm-hmm. Jennifer is probably one of the most sensory-minded individuals I know, and I think that he knows in relation to time and sequencing and being aware of that. And it's just so cool for anyone that hasn't had the time to sit down with both of you or to listen to both of these episodes. As we mentioned, it's so much more than Parkinson's disease or movement disorders or extrapyramidal issues that are uncontrollable, tics, tremors. For you, it was just stepping on a dance floor. For some people that might hear the wrong rhythm or have the wrong song playing at the time, how do we inhibit that? So there's so much here that, as he said, it's really going to be hard to cover in a couple hours, in a couple days. But I think the attendee is going to come away with hopefully even a greater appreciation for the work you do with dance and movement, the work Jennifer does, and the work we do here with PRI. Anyone really following PRI will remember that the brochure last year before COVID hit, we were really excited about the symposium, and we had a band scheduled, and we had a celebration lined up. And, you know, I just want to kind of end by reaffirming the mantra of the last year in preparation for this symposium was the beat goes on, and we're excited for the next month. And we're going to be here beating on with you and anyone else that's really interested in the stuff we talked about, Neil. You have a website called pritrainer.com. Mm-hmm. Many of our listeners, as I mentioned earlier, already are probably familiar with your YouTube channel. Neil puts out so many resources that I turn to on a daily basis for people in the PRI community. So if you're interested in more of what Neil has done and is currently doing and in this presentation for the symposium, I think we all invite you to join us. We're excited, April 22nd and 23rd. And really, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me or anyone at the Institute for, you know, anything that we haven't covered in regards to this symposium and what it will look like and what you will hopefully get out of it. So thanks again, Neil. Thanks, Ron, for sitting down with us. Again, we'll get this posted on your provider page, Neil. If anyone has questions for you, they know where to find you, but thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
If you're interested in learning more about the Postural Restoration Institute, you can visit our website at posturalrestoration.com. You can also email me directly at info@posturalrestoration.com or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter to see how PRI Nation is currently applying this science. As always, thank you for listening, and I look forward to having you on our next episode.